This whole thing about I've got assists, come on.
Liverpool was an incredible club. They didn't coach. They didn't tell you what to do.
You played football in the garden with Marvin Gaye. No, come on.
You thought that that's gone, got rid of racism, and all it took was for three black players to miss penalties, and then you see what actually happens. They said to me, you know, what about all this cancer? I thought they were talking about me. Tell you why I didn't say anything at the time.
Hello and welcome to the Jeff Stelling Show with OLBG. Now, my guest today is recognised as one of the country's greatest ever footballers, and he scored what is broadly accepted to be the finest ever goal scored for the England team.
Thanks, Jeff.
His career started when he came on as a sub in a less than glamorous sounding second tier fixture, Watford against Oldham. He would go on to enjoy a glorious decade at Liverpool, where he won league titles, FA Cups. He was twice Football Writers Player of the Year. He was recognised by his peers because he was PFA Players Player of the Year as well. And he likes a sing-song. Welcome, John Barnes.
More rap than a sing-song.
Yeah.
There's a difference, subtle difference.
Is there a subtle difference?
Absolutely. There? Rapping is more talking, and I speak quickly, and whereas singing is more melodic.
Right. Okay, we will come back to rapping a bit later in the show, I think. I mentioned Watford, and I've got a picture of you in your very early days at Watford here. There you go. Resplendent.
Yeah. You're just looking at the hair there, aren't
you? In Watford kit. I hadn't noticed the difference, to be honest, John, but now you point it out.
Yeah.
But look, I was looking through your records at Watford. 292 appearances in all competitions. The only time you were a substitute was on your debut. That is amazing.
And it's interesting because I made my debut. I came to England when I was 12 and a half. My dad was a diplomat, so it was a diplomatic posting for 4 years. And after 4 years, I've been offered a football scholarship to go to Howard. In fact, I only played rugby at school, went to St. Marylebone Grammar School, played football for a local club. But I knew I was only going to be in England for 4 years because the family were going to go back. My dad was going to go back to be head of the army. I am now going to go to Howard University, got offered a football scholarship to do international relations. 3 months before that happens, I'm playing for Sudbury Court by Wembley Vale Farm. And a taxi driver happens to drive by, which I didn't know. He said, I'm going to watch this game. No one else was watching. I didn't know anybody was there watching. He knew a scout. He must have told the scouts to come and watch me. The scout must have come to watch me because I didn't know. You know, now you will find out somebody's going to come and watch you. Whereas back then, I didn't know a scout came to watch me. First thing we knew is my dad got a call saying, we know John's going to go back to, you know, Jamaica or go to America. But will he come and train at Watford for like, you know, a month before he goes back? And I trained at Watford for a month at 17 years old. And they said, do you want to stay? Offered me a contract. That's the first time I was involved in a professional setup, not an apprentice, never in the youth team, never been at a professional club, 17 years old, signed for Watford, had the preseason at Watford, had one or two games in the reserves before the season started. First game of the season, Watford played away at Newcastle. The reserves, and this is why I love the old days, because the reserves used to play at home on a Saturday at 3 o'clock. First team played away, reserves played at home. So, of course, there's only 300 people in the stand, but you're in the stadium. I mean, reserves now play all over, but whereas the reserves played on a Saturday at 3 o'clock. And I scored a goal against Swindon, 17 years old, first game for Watford, reserve game for Watford. Luther Blitzett gets sent off at Newcastle, first game of the season. And what happened back then, as you know, if you get sent off, you just miss the next game. So the second game of the season, Graham Taylor puts me on the bench for the first team. I've had one reserve game against Oldham. I come on. With 10 minutes to go, 13 minutes to go, I must have done okay, but I don't think I was that spectacular. Third game of the season now, Luther comes back into the team. I expect to go back to the reserves. Graham Taylor doesn't put me on the bench. He puts me in the team against Chelsea away. First game, third game of the season, and I was there ever since.
Let's do the serious stuff and get it out of the way first, John.
I thought that was the serious stuff.
No, because recently you announced you got prostate cancer. How did you find out?
I found out because, and this is quite a while ago, it's interesting how it came out, and never mind how I found out, only because I got checked. I mean, two of my kids are doctors. My dad died of prostate cancer, so, and of course it's prevalent in the black community anyway, so, you know, 6 years ago, I just started doing my PSA, and my kids were like, well, you got to get checked, because I was, I don't know, 56 at the time. So I didn't have any symptoms necessarily or anything like that, but it's just that, as you should do, you should get checked, even if you have no symptoms. So I got checked. And then, of course, after being checked with the PSA being fairly high, and of course, you do the very uncomfortable check as well, and it was slightly raised, your prostate slightly raised, which means nothing because a lot of men die with prostate cancer, not from it, but with it, because it doesn't have to kill you. So when I then had the biopsy, which is the ultimate test, which was terrible, we'd have to snip I have about 40 snips, and then it said, yes, you got prostate cancer. However, it was contained within the prostate, which means that it's fine. It can stay in there forever. But if it burst out, it could give problems. So my kids said to me, two of them, my doctor said, well, why take the chance of it bursting out? It may never burst out, but it will. So I didn't have to have the operation, but I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know it became public knowledge almost accidentally, didn't it?
Well, you know? I think it was very accidentally.
But it's a good thing.
But I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why I didn't say anything at the time, because my dad died of prostate cancer. Yeah. My mother was living in Jamaica by herself. My sisters are in America. I'm her only son. And having lost her husband to prostate cancer, she is now 73. I didn't want her to know. So therefore, I didn't say anything. My mother became a barrister at 69, I can tell you, because she's very proud. So she decided to do a law degree, became a barrister. However, she's there by herself. So I didn't say anything. And I thought, well, am I going to tell her? Am I not going to tell her? My mother passed away a year ago. And because it had been like 4 years since I had the operation, I kind of forgot that I can say it now, because after 4 years, my mom's passed away. I never thought anything about it. I'm now doing about 6 weeks ago, I'm doing a coming up to the World Cup. You know, you do these media days when you're in, you know, different radio stations, LBC, I'm going from station to station. I was with these two women and they said, these two women, they're older women. And then all of a sudden, this cancer thing came up about cancer. Now it was about Kevin Keegan and Kenny Dalglish. So they said to me, you know, what about all this cancer? I thought they were talking about me. And because I'm a professional, I didn't go, oh, how do you know? I just went, well, yeah, you know, I had prostate cancer about 4 years ago and blah, blah, blah. And they never batted an eyelid. So I thought they must have been talking about me. So I then spoke about it. And that's when everyone came out, because they were really talking about Kevin and Kenny. So I'm glad that it came out inadvertently in that way, because now we can just come out and talk about it.
And it's important that it, you know, it's prominent in headlines so that it raises awareness of prostate
Absolutely.
Cancer.
However, it's still a personal, individual thing.
Of course.
If somebody feels they don't want to talk about it, they don't talk about it, which is fine by me. Yeah. So I'm not saying that everybody should come out and talk about it, because it is an individual thing. But for me, the real reason that I didn't say anything was because of my mother. And by the time she had passed away, I forgot that I virtually had it and I hadn't said anything. So I'm glad it inadvertently came out in that way.
Yeah. I mean, the big thing and the message you're putting over all the time, and it's right, because I did, you know, 34 marathons for raise awareness and funds for prostate cancer. And I had not had a test, even though I was preaching to people that they must get tested. I've been tested since. I'm absolutely fine. But the big thing is, you know, go and get tested.
Yeah, there's this big stigma attached to it because, of course, from a woman's perspective, the breast cancer screening, you know, no big deal. You've had it for years and years and there's no stigma attached to it. Whereas, you know, macho men, we feel that, you know, we're going to be less than virile and, you know, it may affect your sexual drive and we don't want anyone to know. So that's the main reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. On top of the real physical test, which is unpleasant as well.
Yeah. But if you go and get tested, you know, and you find you have got prostate cancer, the chances are you're finding it early enough.
If you catch it early enough, that's
perfectly normal life. Yeah. And if you haven't got it, well, wonderful. So,
absolutely.
I mean, it's a no-lose situation, isn't it? John, we'll come back to it in a moment. Before we do, we've got a prize that could not be more fitting today, really. Over at OLBG Prizes, we're giving you the chance to win a signed John Barnes England shirt. And the best bit, it's completely free to enter. It's a beautiful blue Italian 90 shirt, hand-signed by the man himself, John Barnes. One of the most iconic England shirts I think ever made. In truth, signed by the man behind the goal against Brazil. And that rap on New Order's World in Motion. Other raps as well, by the way. It'll definitely be one for the wall if you were to win it. It's completely free to enter. So just head to olbgprizes.com/Stelling. Get your free entry in and you could be the one who wins it. That's olbgprizes.com/Stelling. And the very best of luck to you. 18 plus only, of course, T and C's apply. John, just talking about World Cups, I mean, I think people forget how hard it is to win tournaments, you know. And I was looking back through your records and such, like 1988 Euros, as an example. I looked at the England team then, you know, Lineker, Beardsley, Waddle, Hoddle, Brian Robson, Shiltz, Tony Adams, Viv Anderson, yourself. And yet that England team lost all three games.
Well, we lost. I mean, we shouldn't have lost to the Republic of Ireland. We had so many chances and Gary missed a lot of chances. But this happens in cup football. Then, of course, USSR is going to say Russia. But it was much more difficult back then because you're talking about, you know, when I say less teams and stronger teams, because once the USSR broke up to have all of these teams, once Yugoslavia broke up, you know, so you have a breakup of the European nations, which means that it's much easier now than playing against those teams. But secondly, they were very strong. They were very strong, all of these nations, and there weren't as many as them. So it was much more difficult back then. And as much as you say to win tournaments, if you go through the history of the World Cup, there are not many teams who have won the World Cup. And what you actually see through, maybe not the World Cups in the early days, but I would say since the mid-90s in the World Cup, you've seen a team, Nigeria, 98. You've seen teams come up and you've seen teams and you think, these are dark horses. You saw Morocco got to the semi-final. There are not many teams who have won the World Cup. But once you're getting into the quarterfinals, the semi-finals, it's the same old faces. You know, it's the England, it's the Spain, it's the France. So there are not many teams who've won it. So while you have so many good teams now, you look around and see so many good teams and you think, they've got a great chance of winning it. Portugal have never won the World Cup. Look at that. You know, it's such a difficult thing to win. Because the hardest part is to put a run together. I used to say this about the rugby, the World Cup rugby. So, of course, you know, it's always New Zealand, England, South Africa. There are not that many teams. So you can beat one or two teams and you can win it. Whereas the problem with the World Cup is once you get through to the last 16 or the last eight, you have to put a run together against a good team in the last 16, a good team in the last eight, a good team in the semifinals, a good team in the finals. So to win four games against a top team is difficult.
Yeah.
And that is why, regardless of what goes on early on, look at them, they're great. Look at them, we think that. There are not many teams who've won it, and it's going to be the same old faces.
Even in those days, in 88, though, you know, even the qualifying groups, I mean, at the tournament proper, were impossibly difficult. I mean, you mentioned the fact that, obviously, you got the USSR in those days, but, you know, the Netherlands were in your group.
Yeah.
Look at the squad. Hullet, Van Basten, yeah. Koeman.
And in fact, they went
both
to win
the Koemans.
It. They won it.
Yeah. Frank Rijkaard, Arnold Muren, goodness me.
So what you look at to go through is you look at a game, like England against Croatia, for example. Or, you know, you have a good first win, and you can, you know, like with Scotland, the first win that they had against Haiti, they give them a chance. But of course, the first game, and once you lose to Ireland, the Republic, with all due respect, that's kind of like the next two games are going to be so difficult. So, you know, back then you really want to get off to a good start, which we didn't. And of course, we paid for it.
Yeah. Let's take a look at you in your England gear there.
I'm just looking at the hair once again on the shorts.
It's even more hair.
Hair and shorts. You know, they were obscene, those shorts.
Brilliant. But look, your England career, what struck me was that you the spotlight was always on you. You know, you were always expected to deliver, weren't you? I mean, how difficult was that?
So, I can tell you, my favourite player for England, favourite English player, favourite British player, as much as the Scots and the Irish won't thank me for it, calling him British, technically the best player I've played with, I've seen, and to this day, he would be the first name on the team sheet, is Glenn Hoddle. Technically, Glenn Hoddle was unbelievable. But back then, football wasn't about technique. It was about fight. English football, sorry, was about, and when we played the Republic of Ireland, it was a similar thing. It was about fighting, it was about aggression. Gary will score the goals, Terry Butcher will get his head cut, Brian Robson will be up and down. The technical players weren't used correctly because this is the way football was. So Glenn Hoddle, how many caps did he get? 49, 50? Chris Waddle, myself, we were called inconsistent because the way we played for our clubs, and people used to say to me, play the way for your club, like, play for England the way you play for your club. And I would say, well, if my England played the way my club played, I would. Whereas now, in the last, I would say, 15 years, with the Cole Palmers and the Phil Fodens, English club football has changed so the technical players are much more appreciated. So back then, it was always difficult for the flair technical players because that's just not the way England played. Mm-hmm. So I completely understand the frustration that people had, and Bobby Robson would be the same, and, you know, saying, why don't you play the same way? But any other, and Glenn Hoddle went to France and became the best foreign player in France, you know, and Chris Waddle did the same. So it was just the wrong time for my, that's why I'd love to play now, whereby no one's going to tackle you, they're not going to kick you, you're going to get the ball, you can be much more technical now than you were back then, but you can only play when you're playing.
Mm. I mean, obviously everybody remembers and talks about the goal at the Maracana against Brazil. Was that almost a burden to carry, though?
Well, it was because the expectations are you're going to do that every week. But this is how I explain it, very simply. Because Liverpool played a very technical game. We played like a European team. Alan Hansen, we get out from the back, lots of passes in midfield. And why I played better for Liverpool is because I made better decisions. Meaning that because I knew we were going to dominate possession, we're going to keep the ball, I make better decisions when I got the ball. So when I got the ball, and the right thing was to do was to play it off first time, played simply, I knew that I'd get it again in 20 seconds. I played off simply again. I'll get it again. So then I could pick the time as to when I thought it was right to do the special stuff, because I knew I was going to get so much possession. When I played for England, because of the way we played, every time I got the ball, I felt I had to do something special because I may not see it again for 10 minutes. So therefore, I was making wrong decisions, dribbling at the wrong time because I felt I always had to do this. Whereas for Liverpool, I know I can play it off first time. Lionel Messi plays first time passes and one and two touch 90% of the time because he knows he's going to get a lot of the ball. Then he makes the right decisions and when to dribble. For me, for England, I was making wrong decisions because I felt I'm here to do this and I'm not going to get the ball again. So, and then when if I didn't work, I'll have to try harder the next time. So it was just the way that we played didn't suit me or Chris Waddle or Glenn Hoddle.
Yeah. I mean, look, he's a very different player. But now when I think about the spotlight that was on you then and the level of expectation that was on you then when you pulled on an England shirt and when you talk about making the wrong decisions, you know, can you appreciate that maybe Jude Bellingham finds life a bit difficult in the England shirt for those similar reasons?
Yes, and he shouldn't because he is not a player like me, Chris Waddle, Glenn Hoddle. He's a number 8. He's not a number 10, which means he's very dynamic. He can get forward, he can score goals, he can get back, he can tackle. He's not a Phil Foden or Cole Palmer. And I think that since his move, he's felt that that is what he does, but that is not what he does. That is not who he is, which is why Thomas Tuchel has him in the team for his energy, strength. So I suppose now maybe he feels that that's the type of player he is, and therefore he's trying to do that. Whereas before, if you saw it when he first came on the scene, he wasn't doing that. He was getting forward, he was tackling, getting forward. And the goal he scored, for example, in the, against Croatia, that's what he does. Now, I suppose he's still young and so much has happened to him. He may then feel he's a playmaker, he's a number 10, he's going to get the ball and nutmeg people. That's not what he does. And I think he's getting caught in between what he used to do and because of his prestige and his profile now in thinking that he has to be like a number 10 playmaker, like a Messi or Ronaldo, which is not what he is. And it's not a criticism of him, because what he does in getting forward to score goals and working hard for the team, Thomas Tuchel loves him, you know, because he can play. He's like a Steven Gerrard, because if you said to him, you're going to play as a number 6 as a holding defensive midfield player, he could do that. He could do that. But if you say to him, players are called Palmer number 10 in tight areas, that is not his game. And I think at times he gets caught into trying to do that, which then he gets frustrated when he loses the ball and gets fouled. But no, he still is our probably him and Harry are our most important players. Yeah.
He probably still has to learn that the English psyche is that, you know, we prefer to talk about people's failings rather than their strengths, you know, more often than not.
But he's a strong character. You know, I know I met his mum and dad and they're strong people, they're good people, and he's a fantastic player. And I suppose a lot of people are looking at him now where he's now throwing his arms up and doing certain things, which, you know, maybe that's his character, which is fine. But I'm just talking about from a playing perspective, he's a number 8.
Yeah.
And he shouldn't try and do what Cole Palmer and Phil Foden does, because that's not who he is.
Yeah. When you look back at your England career then, John, do you feel that you underachieved or not?
Well, you know, I maximised my potential in the team that I was in. I couldn't have done any better in that team because the way the team played, and I mentioned, you said the thing about Glenn Hoddle and Chris Waddle. You know, if you thought about us being the 3 technical players, we all underachieved in that respect, but I don't think we could have done any better because the nature of the way the team plays. You know, that's why I'm saying Glenn Hoddle playing today would be an unbelievable player. Chris Waddle playing today. And I think that I like to think that I would love to fit into a team now, any team, because that's the way they play, any of the top teams. So, you know, I'm not, you know, thinking that I could have done better, because knowing my role within that team in regards of the template, the formation, the tactics of what was used back then, I don't think I could have done any better, which may not have been great.
No, I think it was pretty great at the times, mate.
So what happens is, on individual moments, the goal against Brazil, I scored a goal against Uruguay. So the individual moments when you think, oh, look, you did that. But I didn't do that all the time, because most of the time we didn't have the ball. Most of the time we're chasing back. Most of the time we're trying to win the ball and we're not getting the passes in the right areas, the right times, because we're playing with different types of players who don't play that type of football. England was designed for us to defend well, to be strong and win tackles in midfield, get the ball forward for Gary Lineker to score, and that's how we won. So when we played against teams, even like Egypt in the World Cup, technically they were better than us. But back then, the rules of the game meant that you could be very physical. That's how we competed against teams, by being more physical than them. And that's how the Republic of Ireland also competed. So as I said, for the technical players, it didn't really suit us.
Yeah. When you did take criticism, look back at that squad, John, and you and Viv Anderson are the only two black players in the England squad. I'm like, my goodness, how things have changed now. But was there an element of racism about the criticism that you took, do you think?
Not from the press, but obviously from the fans, because there was racism all over football back then. And of course, you know, shouting out and throwing bananas on the field. But even back then, as it is now, if you did well and scored, they loved you. If you didn't play well, that's when your color became an issue. And we thought that that's gone. Right, you know, we got rid of racism, and all it took was for three black players to miss penalties, and then you see what actually happens. Because this is an issue in society, not in football. Football is a part of society, and until we get rid of it in society, it will exist in all walks of society, of which football happens to be one, of which management happens to be one. And it can just look around in society, generally speaking. So from an intellectual and moral point of view, until black people are going to be seen as equal intellectually and morally, they will never be seen as equals. So we can always look at athletes and footballers and play well, and we think we've got rid of it because we love, you know, Frank Bruno, and we love Jude Bellingham, and we love Saka, didn't we? And we love them until they miss penalties, and we can see what actually happens. So it's a very shallow way of looking at it, and a very simplistic way of looking at racism, whereby if we don't hear the abuse, we think it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So,
I'm not going to ask you names, but did you ever feel there was any sort of element of racism towards you within the squads itself?
Well, racism exists everywhere. So while there was an element of racism towards me because they were my teammates, and my teammates would racially abuse other players. So does that mean they're not racist because they're not racially abusing me? This is the environment they're brought up in. This is how they have been conditioned to think. So as much as they love me and I'm their teammate, so I don't blame them at all. This is the environment we live in, whereby, you know, bias exists. And you can look at it from a female perspective as well, in terms of the perception we have of female footballers, female pundits, you know. So it's how we have been wrongly conditioned to think. So race, gender, religion, you know, north, south, as we well know, you're down here, down south. And it's interesting, I was I do lots of events down here, and all the events, I was at one yesterday. And as I'm speaking to a lot of these girls who work in the media, and I'm hearing a hint of a Midlands, a Birmingham. I'm from Birmingham. They went, yeah. I said, what's that to your accent? And they would never admit it. But you know, when you come down here and you want to work in the media, you can't be speaking with a strong Birmingham, Liverpool accent. So you have to, because the perception of people from the north are that they're not as intelligent. So it's not just about race.
Yeah.
It's a perception of someone's, I mean, fortunately for you, you're at a stage now where you can keep your Hartlepool accent, but I'm sure it has softened over.
Oh, look, John, when I first came down to London, I worked for a station called LBC IRN. I'd only been there 2 or 3 weeks, and I'd never been out of the Northeast before, so I spoke with a pretty strong Hartlepoolian accent. And I'd only been on the air for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and my boss got a letter saying, for goodness sake, said, get the new bloke, the one with the Geordie accent, off the air. We can't understand a word he says. And my boss wrote back, who was very defensive, and said, Jeff's got a regional accent. I'm sure you'd agree, in this day and age, regional accents should be encouraged. This bloke wrote back again and said, yeah, regional accents should be, but speech defects should not. I mean,
no, but here's the interesting thing, Jeff, about that, because while we talk about it, we think it's about fitting in, yeah? And in many respects, people go, oh, you know, you're fitting in, blah, blah, blah. It's a perception. And I'll tell you why it's a perception, why it's a negative perception, because I know if a person from down south with a London accent goes up to Liverpool, Newcastle, anywhere like that, they don't feel they have to change their accents. And they would not change their accents, because the perception is, they're from the south. They're more intelligent. They're better than us. So as much as they're saying, oh, it's about fitting in, so why don't the people from the south, when they grow up north, trying to put on a Geordie accent?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I remember my best mate, actually, when he first...
In fact, they hold on to their accents.
Yeah, you know, he did. But, you know, when my mate turned up at school, he wasn't my mate then, he was from Slough. Mm. And in Hartlepool, we didn't have met anybody from Slough, you know. These are these exotic creatures. And he spoke with this, you know,
Cockney.
Exotic accent. almost Cockney in a way. And because of that, there was a certain level of prejudice against him, you know, which I was just desperate for friends, you know. So I put my arm around him and said, come on, son. Look, no criticism when people reflect on your career. I was looking at some of the comments, you know, Tony Adams.
Jeff, you don't have to keep saying that. Plenty of criticism. So just say, reflect on your career.
You know, I got lots of criticism. No, these are the positive things. So, you know, Tony Adams would have you in his all-time dream team. Peter Beardsley, who I know you're mates with. He described you as the best player in the world for 3 or 4 seasons. Jamie Carragher, the best technical player I ever played or trained with. He didn't mention your rapping, by the way. But best technical player I ever played or trained with. I mean, when you look back at your career and comments like that, it must give you a buzz.
Well, you know, this is where I remember, and you mentioned about the criticism. I remember when I was like 19, I was playing for England. And of course, we're fairly perverse in England, meaning that we like the underdog. In America, they don't want the underdog. They want the person who's going to be the best. So we love Watford. The press love Watford. We finished second in the league. We beating Liverpool, Arsenal, Man United. Liverpool won the league. We second, Man United third. They love me playing for Watford, the underdog. Then when I played for England, the press were giving me a hard time. And I was 19 and I'm going through this whole thing. And I remember Graham Taylor said to me, he said, you know, when you play for Watford and they tell you you're fantastic and you're brilliant, the media, he said, do you believe them? He said, if you believe them, when you play for England and they criticize you, you have to believe that as well. So you don't take the praise and the criticism from the press and stuff like that. So as you mentioned, the people there who you play with, your teammates and your fans and the managers, that's who you listen to. So therefore, listening to that, these are people who know me. So that is why you wondered, how do you handle that? And Gazza couldn't handle that. Because when the press used to love Gazza, Gazza used to play up to them and he loved them, go out with them and he loved them, then they criticize him and he would go out and hate them. And I said, so I don't get involved in stuff like that. So, you know, these are nice words and words from the people who I take more notice of. Like when he said, I won the PFA Player of the Year, I won the Sports Writers Player of the Year, Sports Writers twice, PFA once.
Yeah.
With all due respect to the sports writers, the PFA one meant more to me because they're from your peers.
Yeah.
And that's who you really listen to.
Yeah, get that completely. I mean, you mentioned one of your managers there. You had some big name managers internationally and at club level over the years. But would your first manager at club level be your favourite then, Graham Taylor?
Absolutely, absolutely. I suppose it's like, you've got to be careful when I have to say things like this. But my wife understands. I suppose it's like your first girlfriend, isn't it? You know, you can't always remember. So, but not only that, because he influenced me greatly, because he was very similar to my dad. My dad was very strict. He's a colonel in the army, so he's very strict, very disciplined. And that's the way I was brought up, very disciplined. When I first came to England and I played for Stowe Boys Club at 13 years old, fantastic boys club, won every game in Regent's Park, but I came late to the team because they were there from they were 12. I'm now 13, joined the team in the under 13s. No one wanted to play as a centre back. So my dad said, you're going to play as a centre back to your team because your first responsibility is to the team, not to yourself. I was never a centre-back. So for 4 years, I played as a centre-back. Before I went to Watford, I played as a centre-back. I was never a centre-back, but responsibility to the team. And that's what Graham Taylor spoke about. So I went to Watford. I remember playing against Liverpool, interestingly, 20 years old. And Graham Taylor picked the team on the day. And at Watford, very much like how managers should be, Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola, you had a responsibility of position. So therefore, the left back plays this way. So Graham was like that. And we understood everybody's position, everybody's role. Playing on the left wing, I knew how to play right back. As a right back, not as John Barnes. He said to me on the day of the game, we're playing Liverpool. And he said, pick the team. And of course, he just had your number 11. And he said, right, you're playing in midfield now to man mark John Walk. Never played in midfield before, but I understood how Kenny Jackett played in midfield. And he said, you're going to play in midfield on man-mark John Walk. So I man-marked John Walk for the 90 minutes. He never got a kick until he scored the winner. Yeah. I lost him once and he scored the winner. So the point I'm making is that my responsibility was always to the team. I had so much discipline. And that's what Graham Taylor spoke about. And that's how we finished second in the league. And they would have been playing Hartlepool a few years earlier in the fourth division, yeah, as you know. And 80% of those players played in the fourth division. When we finished second in the league to Liverpool, and Man United finished third, 80% of those players, Ray Train, Malcolm Poskett, they would have been playing in the fourth division. So how could that happen because of Graham Taylor as a manager, very strong manager?
Yeah, incredible. And a reflection, really, what you were saying earlier on, because when he was manager of Watford, everybody loved him. When he became manager of England, yeah, you know, suddenly the critics were
absolutely coming. And he was very naive, because I tell you, Graham Taylor loves England. He loves England. And, you know, he's a person who, like, we're all in this together. We're going to get praise. And everybody wants us to do well. Now, at Watford, he had that. Because the press love Watford beating the big boys. Unfortunately, as you well know, the media, when it comes to England and Bobby Robson, threw something similar. And what Graham felt, he couldn't understand that. He thinks everybody has to love England. So he opened himself up to the press and saying, I'll just be open and honest with you. Because, of course, I'm sure you want us to do well as well. And of course, unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. So he was naive in thinking that everybody and Bobby went through something similar. But, you know, he was such an honourable man. He was a great man.
Graham was a dream to deal with from a media perspective as well. I mean, I remember, and this has gone back to a time when things were very different, admittedly. So I was working for Five Live and I was covering, he was Villa manager. So I was covering, I think it was West Ham, Aston Villa, something like that. And afterwards, the radio station would want to play a live and things. So in those days, you just literally went and knocked on the dressing room door. And you knocked on the Villa dressing room door, and Graham answered the door. And he just said, "Yeah, yes, Jeff." He said, what do you want? I said, just to play. He said, "Who do you want?" I said, "Well, Alan Evans." And you can hear the voice in the background, "Evans, out of the shower, downstairs, Five Live, want you now, 5 minutes."
Yeah.
And that was the way it worked.
Very strong. Fantastic. But I'll tell you a Graham Tenor story, which is an unbelievable story, because this would have been 1983, maybe 84. This was when there wasn't a conversation to be had about racism in football. You had racist abuse at football matches. No one even battered an eyelid. No one talked about it after. Lots of racist abuse. Now, Watford is a very inoffensive club, as you know. We're playing against Oldham, and they have a centre forward. I think it was Palmer. Roger Palmer, a black player.
Yeah.
This is 1983. And played against Oldham. And of course, you don't hear any abuse at Watford anyway. You know, so of course, you know, I'm sure it goes on, but you don't really hear it. And we played against Oldham. Halftime came. We went in the dressing room. Graham was in the dressing room. Wasn't in the dressing room. Sam Ennis took the team talk, and 2 minutes before we went out, Graham just came back in and he goes, "Right, lads, let's go, ready to go out, blah, blah, blah." We never heard of, didn't know what had happened. What had happened, which we didn't even know about, and Luther told me years later, is that Graham was on the bench and he heard one or two Watford fans racially abusing Roger Palmer. How could he even hear that? Because, I mean, Watford, you know, they don't make much noise anyway, but he must have heard one or two comments in the stand. We went in at halftime, he got the microphone. He went out into the center circle with the microphone and he said, "I've heard some racist abuse. We've got Luther Blitzer, John Barnes. If I any hear any racist abuse of any player from the opposition, you'll never come to this club again." Never told the press, never told anybody, came in, never made a song or dance about it. That's in 1983.
Yeah.
He was
wonderful.
A great man.
Wonderful, yeah. Oh, by the way, talking of great men, of course, there was somebody else involved with Watford Football Club. There we go. You recognise in the middle
there. I thought you were going to say Maurice Johnson then for a second, because he was a great man on a night out, yeah. I can tell you.
Well, I was thinking Elton John.
Listen,
but
Elton was fantastic. Yeah. Elton was great.
Did you have much to do with him?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Elton was fantastic. Because Elton, let me tell you, Elton understood football. And why I say that, and I say this all the time, because, you know, if Elton wanted to be the owner of a football club, and for the prestige, as you see now, lots of owners coming to football clubs from America all over to buy them because of the prestige of the club and it gives them. He wouldn't have Watford in the fourth division. He would have got Arsenal, Tottenham. He's got enough money, but that's his club. He loved his club, bonded with his dad, and he was a real fan, and he understood how to get success at Watford. And how to get success at Watford is how you get success at every football club. The manager's the most important person, not you, not the owners, not the chief executives, it's the manager. So he was subservient to Graham. He was subservient. He would call him boss. And sometimes when he'd come in and, you know, before the game, this is his club from the fourth division. We're getting the UEFA Cup. We've finished second in the league. We get into the cup final. He's excited. And Graham would go, "Elton, leave, go away. I'm trying to talk to the players." And he'll go, "Sorry, boss, sorry, boss." He had this thing. Why he did that is because he understood that even if the players see that the owner of the football club is afraid of the manager, when the manager says jump, we have to jump. The Hillwoods at Arsenal, Morris family at Liverpool, they were the same. Ferguson, Dalglish, Paisley, George Graham, they were the most important ones. And that has that not a football club. So if you look at the three most successful clubs in the last 10 years, Jurgen Klopp, Liverpool, he's the most important one. Pep Guardiola, Mikel Arteta. Mikel Arteta finished eighth in his first year, eighth in his second year, fifth. But because they backed him and he was strong, he was allowed to be strong, he's successful. So that's what Elton did. Elton loved the club. He'd put money in the club. And I remember Graham saying, and he would say this in front of him. He goes, "We don't want your money. We know you got lots of money and you can give us your money, but this club has to be able to stand on its own 2 feet. So yes, you're going to help the club." And he'd say it. "We're not going to him for money." Whereas now what do we say? Spend more money, spend more money. Elton would love to have spent money but Graham understood that that's not how you get success. The club has to be the club without you. And he was so strong and he affected his, you know, his life. So Elton was just so normal when he was around Graham. Of course, after he left, then Elton was Elton, wasn't he? But when he was around the club, we didn't see the flamboyancy at all. Elton was a proper chairman. Graham would say to him, "You're a proper chairman. You dress properly. You come in." He'd say this in front of the players and he'll go, "Okay, boss, okay, boss." He understood.
Yeah. I'm lucky enough to know Elton a little. And he's just a good man. You know? Just a good man. Look, was it daunting to go to Liverpool then? I mean, this is a massive club. Kenny Dalglish, huge name.
Well, you know, I had 6 years at Watford. I had probably half my caps at Watford, not at Liverpool. I had 6 years. I had shown a level of consistency over a period of time to then say, you're ready for Liverpool. Brian Robson, West Brom, 6-7 years. Peter Beardsley, 7 years, Newcastle. John Aldridge. Nowadays, you have a young player who has one good season. He costs £80 million. You see the inconsistency. Back then, Liverpool looked at you and they said, yes, goal against Brazil, 1984. Did I then leave? I don't know, 3 years. Made my debut in 83. They don't just sign you. So they look and say, you have to show a level of consistency. So it was daunting in being the first black player, apart from Howie Gale, who you know, was playing there. A lot of pressure. First one they signed for money. But I felt comfortable. I was ready for it. I'm 23, and Liverpool knew I could fit into what they wanted because they didn't coach you. As you know, they don't coach at Liverpool. They look in and say, you can fit into what we want by working it out yourself. So they look at your knowledge as to how you're going to play. You can fit into what we want because we're not going to tell you. Liverpool was an incredible club. They didn't coach. They didn't tell you what to do.
Is it still run that way?
No. Football has changed. Okay, I mean, that changed. That was Bill Shankly, Bob Paisley, Kenny Dalglish, because Joe Fagan. That they did it the Bill Shankly way. Times change where you got a coach player. So Liverpool didn't sign superstar 17 and 18 year olds. They signed players when they got to 22, 23 that you can look at if you had the character. Who did I say was my favorite player? Glenn Hoddle. Never played for Liverpool. He's not better. He's not worse. They look at your character, say, can you fit into, first of all, Northern life, being a Scouser? You can't be too pretty with a Cockney accent, middle on here and tight shorts. So they also have the right character. So I was amazed how quickly it worked in the first couple of weeks in preseason. And don't forget, how did Watford play? Long balls. Liverpool play that way. How am I going to do? I'm going to fit in. They went, you'll be fine, son. I didn't think I'd fit into the way Liverpool play. They're a technical team. Secondly, I thought I was going to play up front with John Aldridge because I signed for Liverpool the week before Peter. Rushy had gone. I'm coming and I played up front against Liverpool that game, scored a couple of goals. Every wide player wants to play centre forward. Played centre forward for Watford a few times against Liverpool, scored. I'm coming to play up front with John Aldridge because Rushy is gone. 1 week later, they've signed Peter Beardsley. So I've said to them, I said, well, where am I going to play? He said, you're playing on the left. I said, yeah, but when I play on the left for Watford, I get the ball down the line, crosses. Liverpool don't play that way. You'll work it out, son. And from the first week in training, I'm coming in playing 1-2s, getting the ball from the back four, which I never did at Watford. But you have to work it out yourself.
Yeah. Well, you worked it out pretty quickly, didn't you? Because I think you won the title in your first season. Mm. 17 goals, all competitions.
Yeah.
Reached the FA Cup final.
You don't know how many assists, do you?
How many? No, I don't.
Neither do I, because it wasn't a thing.
Ah.
You scored goals, or that was it. This whole thing about I've got assists, come on.
You're not having that.
It's ridiculous, because listen, I'm playing with Diego Maradona. I give him the ball, 2 yards on a halfway line. He dribbles around 10 players. I've assisted him. Come on, it's a load of rubbish. Interestingly, for Liverpool, though, it was really strange, because I mentioned about the way we actually played and how everybody just fitted in. Biggest lesson I learned at Liverpool, won the league that year. Came in, Ronnie Moran had the medals in a plastic bag. This is after we won the league. Put him on the table and he said, pre-season training July the 5th. We never got carried away. We didn't have a big celebration. We didn't go out and say, because it has to be the repetition. And how do you keep that hunger and that repetition? Is after you've done it, forget about it. So they didn't make a song and dance where they've won it because you've got to be hungry to do it again. That's an easy attitude to have when you've won. What about when you've lost?
Hmm.
Arsenal next year, lost the last game of the season. Last minute of the last game of the season.
Yeah, memorable. Came in.
Yeah. Losers medals on the table. Preseason training July the 5th. We didn't wallow in self-pity and despair, or we'd never have raised ourselves to win the league like we did in the following year. Because what you do is you play with authenticity, effort, commitment, determination. And if you win, you win. You lose, you lose. Yeah? So, as Rudyard Kipling says, those two imposters, triumph and disaster, that's what we did. Yeah. We gave 100%, and if you lost, you lost. So we didn't get carried away when we won. We didn't wallow in self-pity and despair when we lost.
Was that the case after the Wimbledon Cup final as well? Absolutely. Because that was one of the biggest shocks in football
Absolutely.
History.
Well, time. I don't know why it should be. Wimbledon finished seventh or eighth in the top division.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, in terms of the size of the clubs and in terms of the reality of these two clubs, it was a huge. But if you're talking about a team who finishes seventh in the top division, in the Premier League, beating a team who finishes first in the Premier League, why is that such a big upset? It was being disrespectful to Wimbledon. So I understand in terms of the context of the size of the clubs, but in the reality of those two clubs with the players they had, international players, they're finishing seventh in the league, we're winning the league, it wasn't that big of an upset.
Yeah.
But once again, and we didn't go into that game disrespecting them because they're Wimbledon. We're going to, you know, we played every game as if it was a cup final, if you like, and against the top opposition. So we weren't complacent. And in fact, you know, if you look at the score, a goal shouldn't have been disallowed. Referee brought it back to give us a free kick. John Aldridge missed the penalty. It wasn't the greatest of game, but these things happen. These things happen.
I mean, yeah, obviously, a glorious decade there. Well, actually, before I ask you about your favourite players, what was your sort of We all talk about the Brazil goal, but you must have favourite goals at QPR. Liverpool. QPR. Is what that, is that the slalom in run through?
That's my favourite goal, but my favourite game was the Nottingham Forest game where we won 5-0 because that was a proper game. Why I say that's my favourite game and why it was a proper game of football is because Forest were a good team at the time and we had the history of Hillsborough and stuff like that. So there's this kind of like, you know, Percy kicking people and the animosity to him and whatever. So anyway, so it was a big rivalry and we played that game. And when I say it's a proper game of football, I mean that when we were 5-0 up, if I got the ball and I wanted to nutmeg people and do olays and show off, the crowd would be going, olay, and if I lost it, it doesn't matter. Make fun of them. We didn't do that for the full 90 minutes. If being 5-0 up and I had to chase back, or Ray Hunt had to chase back 50 yards to make a tackle, when you don't have to, you're 5-0 up, the game's over, we did it. We played the game like it was 0-0, which is what you have to do. Because we've seen teams when they're 5-0 up start to show off and the fans are going olay, or we've seen teams when they're 5-0 down and they're not playing. So I always say, play the game like it's 0-0, which means that when you're 5-0 up, you make the correct decisions. And that Nottingham Forest game where Sir Tom Finney said it's the greatest game he's ever seen, for me was my favourite game ever. And I wasn't man of the match necessarily, but it was just a great team performance.
Wonderful. Of all the players that you played with over those 10 years, Bidder, was it?
Oh, favourite player? I only played with him for England before, but Peter was only there not for very long. But when you talk about, and the person I liken him to now is my favourite Liverpool player of recent time, Bobby Firmino. So when you think about Mane, Firmino and Salah, the reason those two did it what they did because of Bobby Firmino. The unseen work, the hard work, to create for them, to work hard for them. And that's what Peter did. Peter would work hard for the team, playing in midfield, so he does a lot of the unseen work. Ray Houghton, I have to mention as well. Because what happened in football, when you talk about the balance, and we spoke about it, we got the praise down the left, Stevie Nicol going down the corner, and John Barnes down the left, down the right, Barry Venison and Ray Houghton. Now, because they didn't get as much praise as we did, because we're being flamboyant, but they compensated for that from a balance point of view, who were much stronger in midfield. In fact, you think about the person who nearly made that tackle for Michael Thomas when he went through was Ray Houghton. You know, I was playing somewhere else. So what I'm saying is that players like that, I appreciate. My favourite player, I mentioned him, Ronnie Whelan. Remember Steve McMahon going forward, scoring goals, Ronnie Whelan, on Son Work, playing on the left, in the middle, just does the work, and that's a Liverpool player. Jimmy Kay, Sammy Lee, they're the Liverpool players, not the flamboyant ones, and they're the players I appreciate.
I love it, love it. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment. I just want to remind people, though, don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel. We've got some terrific guests coming up, plenty of stories from across the game, and, of course, plenty of strong opinions as well along the way. So if you're watching on YouTube, just hit the subscribe button, and while you're there, tap the bell icon so you know when the next episode will land. And thanks for always being with us as well. Right. He did become a manager, became a coach, if you like. Went on to coach England. And in many people's eyes, was unfortunate to lose
absolutely.
The job.
Absolutely. Yeah. Way ahead of his time. Yeah. He could be coaching England now.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Why do you think coaching or management didn't work out for you?
Well, interestingly, when you look at my record at Celtic, if I was to tell you that my record at Celtic is better than Steven Gerrard's record at Rangers from a win percentage. I had a 66% win percentage at Celtic, 65.8. But of course, when you're managing Celtic, and at that particular time, not so much now, if you finish second and Rangers win the league, you're a failure. And what had happened at Celtic was the disharmony and disunity at Celtic Football Club at that time. If you remember, Rangers were spending a lot of money, whereas Celtic wasn't. If you look at the previous owners who were there at the time, they had a lot of players on contracts that they weren't happy with. So when I got there and they thought that Leash and Barnes are here now, contracts are going to spend lots of money, and they weren't. So the players, they had them on contracts, so the players were unhappy. So we won 12 of the first 13 matches and they were still unhappy because of the politics around it. And of course, from the start, as I said, even winning 12 of the first 13 matches, from the second, third, fourth match, I was being given a hard time by the press. I didn't have a relationship with Celtic. You had a lot of Celtic players, who names I don't have to mention, who were very powerful in the press with their friends who were not happy. And as I said, 12 of the first 13 matches, no, we'd won 11, drawn one, lost one. We were 4 points behind Rangers, and I knew it wasn't going to work because there was just so much unhappiness at the club at that particular time. And I wasn't a big name manager to be able to handle that. So I remember even saying to my ex-wife, now but a wife at the time, after the first 5 games, don't come up. I'm not going to be here long. So,
Five games.
Yeah. So I didn't move up. I lived in a flat, but I didn't move the family up because I knew that it wasn't going to last. Because I thought, well, if we are 4 points behind Rangers and we have, and I'm going through this this abuse from the media and from the fans, because the media are very powerful. And then, you know, I thought, well, if I go through a sticky patch here, I'm finished. And then playing away at Lyon, Henry Claassen broke his leg. He wasn't going to play for us again. And the next game, Rangers at home, we're winning 2-1 just before halftime. Paul Lambert slides in on Jörg Alberts, gives a penalty away. As Jörg Alberts goes over him, he gets a knee in the jaw, breaks his jaw, lost all his teeth, scored a penalty 2-2. And I remember, because it was at Ibrox, and this is just before halftime, so Paul Lambert is now unconscious, on a stretcher, brings him into the dressing room, and the ambulance, because of the crowd, couldn't come down for another 15 minutes. So my team talk is, having been 2-1 up, now he's 2-2, I've got to give him the team talk. He's lying on the bench of me giving the team talk with no teeth, broken jaw, moaning, and the players are just sitting there like that. So we lost 4-2 in that game. So then after that, that's when it really became difficult, because without Larsen and Lambert, it was always going to be difficult. We had a fantastic player called Mark Viduka, who then decided that he wants to leave. So in January, he comes in and he goes, right, I want to go. And I was like, well, Mark, why do you want to go? He was like, because the what had happened when he first came was, when Mark Viduka came, he's playing in Croatia, and Celtic came in for him. He didn't want to go to Celtic. He didn't want to go to Celtic, but he wanted to go to Italy. But they came in with money, cash up front, and the Croatian owner said, you're going to Celtic. I don't care what you want. So he's going to Celtic. So he didn't really want to come, but he came and he started playing well. But because he had come under those circumstances when things weren't, he didn't really particularly want to come, the owner at the time said to him, you know, okay, well, just come. And if you're not happy, you can then leave for £4 million. You can leave if you're not happy. So that's the season before. Me and Kenny have come, rehabilitation. Him and Larsen are scoring goals. Everything is great. He's scoring goals. But then he comes, he goes, right. I said, what do you mean? And he goes, because the owner said to me, the CEO said to me that I can leave if I'm not happy. I go, but why are you not happy? You're scoring goals. You're front with Henry. Everything's going well. Nobody has said. So I went to the CEO and I said, did you tell him you can leave? He goes, yeah, but there's nothing in writing. I said, it doesn't matter if it's in writing. You know what Mark's like. You've said to him, he can go. He wants to go, regardless of whether he's in writing or not. So then, because he didn't go, he's now all upset. So he's upset. His best mate, who was our best player, Lubo Moravcek. I don't remember Lubo Moravcek.
Yes, indeed.
So Lubo Moravcek had come from a club in France. No one knew of him. He was unbelievable. So when you're 32, 31, you come from a club in France, you're going to sign a decent contract, but it's not going to be a great contract. Then when he turned out to be the best player in Scotland, he wants a new contract. So he's not getting a new contract. Viduka wants to leave. Larsen's out injured for the season. Lambert, so it was a disaster. So, and I got, and in fact, in the January, I got manager of the month in January, because we're only going to win the games. Manager of the month in January, February started, lost one game, and they sacked me. But that's football. That's football.
No mural on the end of a Glasgow house, but I wanted to show this one because this is Anfield, obviously, isn't it? You know, I mean, that is just sensational.
Yeah, and they have them, and there's now, obviously, there's the Jota one of Kenny, there's yeah. Rushy. I mean, Kenny and Rushy, you can see Anfield in the background. I mean, Kenny and Rushy are right there at Anfield, but, you know, it's not a competition. That's around the corner. But, of course, it's great. And, of course, because, you know, it's not the most salubrious of areas, Anfield. So I don't think that, I suppose if we played, you know, for Chelsea, I don't think they would have put them up. I don't think the people in Chelsea would have it on their houses. Yeah, but it's good because, you know, when you play for Liverpool, you're part of a community, part of a family. And, you know, Bill Shankly was a socialist. And when you talk about working class area, working class people, the club, as much as football has changed, they still have that relationship with the community. So, yeah, that was nice, that honour. I hope it stays there.
Yeah, it was wonderful. I've seen a couple of them. They're absolutely wonderful. Look, we're going to run out of time, and I want to talk about music with you just for a minute or two. Because before we talk about your rapping, I read a story which just blew my socks off. Because I think you're from a sort of musical family, aren't you?
Politics and music.
Politics and music.
Politics and music.
So you played football in the garden with Marvin Gaye. No, come on.
So when we came from Jamaica, my mother's family are very political. They started the first Jamaican government, and her family are also in our, you know, they're entrepreneurs and empresarios. And her uncle used to manage Marvin Gaye. So of course, Marvin Gaye was in concert here. We lived in Highgate at the time, or Golders Green, and he came over for a concert, so he came to our house for dinner. I was 14 years old. I was not a footballer at the time, and Marvin Gaye said his son played football as well, so we went and played football in the garden. But in Jamaica, we don't have this either this hierarchy or this celebrity kind of life, which means that if you meet people, you don't take pictures and autographs and stuff. So Usain Bolt, for example, will walk down the street in Jamaica and people just go, "Hi, Usain," and they don't make a big deal of it. Whereas Usain Bolt here, everyone's going to go, "Usain Bolt." So the fact that, you know, and I'm just looking at my family now and I'm like, why don't we take any pictures of Marvin Gaye? And Bob Marley was on the radio station with my mom. He used to come. You'd been to my mom knew Bob Marley. And so in Jamaica, when you have people who are celebrities, but we don't make a big deal of it. So yes, I did. Play. In fact, when my dad managed the Jamaica national team, he was a colonel in the army. Famous footballer Alan Cole for Jamaica, Rastafarian. Bob Marley was his little sidekick. So he used to come to training with Jamaica when my dad was the manager. And Bob Marley would come with Alan Cole on the back of his bike to the training. And my dad said, "Why are you bringing this boy into training?" And because, you know, they're smoking what they're smoking. And so Bob Marley with his guitar was always in the dressing room. And so, yeah, it's an interesting place, Jamaica.
Yeah. Oh, well, those are great names. That's an image I can't get out of my head. You know, you played football with Marvin Gaye. Brilliant. So the rapping, I mean, obviously there was the sort of rap section on World in Motion, the Anfield rap. Mm-hmm. Is it true that for the rap section on World in Motion, you were paid the grand total of £200?
Well, listen, my maths is not great. So it would have been, I think it was about £5,000 into the players' pool to split between the pool. And the players. Because we didn't know it was going to be New Order. We thought it was just going to be a World Cup song like we did in 86. We did Viva España. Got to number 80. That was the players' arms around each other. Here we go, here we go. We thought that was what it was going to be. So when Bobby Robson says, go and do this new record, we didn't know it was going to be with a group, New Order, and Keith Allen was there. So only six people turned up to do the song. Me, Gazza, Peter Beardsley, Des Walker, Steve McMahon, Chris Waddle. No one else turned up. Because you play for your club on a Saturday. This is in February. Play for your club on Saturday. Meet up with England on Sunday to play France in a friendly in February. And that's when we're going to do the song. So Bobby Robson says, instead of meeting up with England on the Sunday, just go to these studios in Marlow, Buckinghamshire, make the record, meet up with England on Monday. All the players heard was, we don't have to meet up with England on Sunday. Song's going to be terrible because the last one in 86 was. So they didn't come. They went to the pub, the rest of the players. When we turned up and we saw Keith Allen, Peter Hook, Bernie Sumner, that's the first time we knew that it was going to be a proper song with a group. We thought it was going to be like the Anfield rap and the other songs where you see, you know, Tottenham Cup final songs where it's just the players' arms around each other. So therefore, when, you know, you go to the World Cup and you then sign an agreement for, you know, sponsorships, money coming into the players' pool and the song, they thought, well, we had a choice. And of course, the committee of the Bright Ones, Shilton and Lineker, they were in the committee. And the choice was, you can get royalties or you can just get a lump sum into the players' pool, £5,000 to share between you. And the committee said, well, do royalties mean that if we don't sell any records, we get nothing? They went, yeah, they said, we'll take the £5,000. Because we didn't know it was going to be a New Order song. Yeah. So I think we made the wrong decision. So,
And how did you get the starring role, if you like, in this?
I got the starring role because
Well, it was obvious because you got the best voice. Well, you're the best rapper, you know.
I don't know how long you've got, but just give me a second. How I got a starring voice was a starring role because, first of all, we live in a democracy. So I can't choose to say I'm going to be the best one. Remember who was there? Me, Gazza, Peter Beardsley, Chris Waddle, Des Walker. It was between me and Des. And Des is not black musically, let me tell you. So I did it. However, we all had to have a wrap off. We all had to do it. So everybody had to go at it.
Yeah, you weren't aware at the time. That actually become a big part of your life. No, people ask for you to do stuff everywhere.
So the thing about it is, first of all, we didn't know it was going to be a New Order song. We thought it was going to be our song. I remembered 86, we entered the charts at number 80, left at 96. We thought it was going to be similar. So we did the song. So after doing this song now, we go to the World Cup. The song then comes up, but we're in Italy. So they're playing the song here, everyone's excited, but we don't know that because, of course, we're in Italy, and it's not now where you got social media and you got that, everything comes back. So we didn't know what was happening until it got to number one while we're in Italy, and then we had a live link-up with Top of the Pops, and that live link-up, all of the players were there, you know, on Top of the Pops and talking about the record. Bobby saying, none of them turned up. As I said, we're the only six who turned up. But when it got to number one, they were all there saying it's our song. They all got a gold disc because we weren't really aware of the Ferrari and everything that was going on back here. Because you're in Italy. Now, when we had a live link up with the television and stuff like that, we saw Trafalgar Square, we saw how huge it was. But when you're in the World Cup, you don't really know that because you're away in Italy, you're playing your game, so you're not aware of how it was. So that was a special World Cup, 1990, particularly for people back at home, which we didn't know, A, until we saw that live link up, and B, until we came home and saw it.
Brilliant. John, great stories. Could talk for a lot longer, but we are out of time. Thank you so much for coming in, mate.
No, it's a
really
pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
John Barnes, make sure you join us next time on The Jeff Stelling Show with OLBJ.